In a moment, by the way, we're going to go to Las Vegas, where Linda Moulton Howe is live with two guests, Jim Mars the first half, Richard Dolan the second, as we talk about some extraterrestrial information. Linda is at the third annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference at the Embassy Suites Hotel and Conference Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. Let's turn the microphone over to her. Hi, Linda.
George, we miss you.
Well, hey, I got to work back here.
Well, I'm sure glad that we can at least give a little Whitman's chocolate sampler of some really hard-hitting and substantive presentations that are going to be here this week. And the theme is crash retrievals of what are known as unidentified flying objects or UFOs. And with me is one of my most favorite reporters in the world. He is honest. He is groundbreaking. He is the author of the late 1980s book Crossfire that Oliver Stone turned into the feature film JFK, which was also groundbreaking. He is the author of Alien Agenda. I think it set a certain bar and level of quality and introduction about how serious this whole subject of non-human entities interacting with the Earth is. And his third book, Rule by Secrecy, came out in 2000 and is considered by many of us to be one of the hard reference books for both the history of this country and its relationship with other history going all the way back to Mesopotamia. And then his most recent book that came out in 2004 is a brilliant look with the help of the firefighters in New York about some of the unknown and undiscussed publicly, the areas of what happened in 9/11. It's called Inside Job, Unmasking the 9/11 mm-hmm. Conspiracies. And he's here tonight to share with us on Coast to Coast one of, and maybe it is the oldest, crash retrieval case that any of us have any evidence for. And right now, I'm going to go to Jim to take us back to 1897 and Aurora, Texas.
Almost
Jim, what happened?
Well, whatever actually happened in Aurora, Texas, which is located about 20 miles north of Fort Worth, it made the front page of the Dallas Morning News. And according to the story, about 6 o'clock in the morning of April the 17th, a silver cigar-shaped object drifted in from the south and then reached a windmill that belonged to Judge Proctor and went to pieces with a terrific explosion. Now, that's astounding enough, being 1897, because keep in mind, folks, this was 6 years before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. And I know over the years, I've always, you know, when the subject of UFO comes up, it was always been, well, it's just misidentified aircraft or satellites or some kind of secret government test craft. And I've often thought, wouldn't it be great if there was a really well-documented UFO story before any of that stuff was in the air? And here it is. So the silver cigar-shaped object crashed, which is startling enough, but the third paragraph of the story states the pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one aboard, and while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world. Whoa, so we've got, what, aliens crashed in 1897? And, of course, there's been a lot of controversy about this story all through the years. Mm-hmm. I began working on this in 1973 when I was an aviation aerospace writer for the Fort Worth newspaper. And at that time, I was highly skeptical of this story. But as the years went on and as more and more information came to light and as I studied it more and more closely, I became much more convinced that something indeed had happened.
And, you know, Jim, when I was working on A Strange Harvest, I talked with Tom Adams and Gary Massey from Texas, and they had gone there before that grave had apparently been, I guess the marker had been removed, which, George, is a really strange part of the story mm-hmm. because there were people who said that they had seen some kind of evidence of this creature, and here was this grave. And Jim, could you explain to the best of your ability, what is the hardest evidence that there actually was a strange, small, unidentified body that was buried, and then somebody took that very bizarre marker?
In 1973, when I began to investigate this story, this little strange gravestone was still there. It looked like a piece of sandstone, and it did not have any writing on it, but it had a V-shaped carved into it, laying on its side, with little circles in there. And I became pretty convinced, because of the shape of this thing, that it was maybe half of it had gotten broken off and was missing. And if you duplicated the side that was actually there, and flopped it and put it to the other side, you've got a saucer-shaped object with little portholes, I guess. But there's no question that there was this grave, and it was in the Aurora Cemetery. In fact, the story that was published in the morning news says the pilot's funeral would take place tomorrow, and the Fort Worth papers also covered this and said that the little pilot was buried in the Aurora Cemetery. Now, when I and the aviation writer of the Dallas Times-Herald at the time wrote some stories about this in 1973, there got to be, needless to say, a little bit of public interest, and people were driving up there and trying to look at the cemetery, so they put a police guard on the cemetery for about 2 weeks. And then the very night that they pulled the police guard, the little tombstone went missing, has not been seen since. But the reason that I tend to think this may have been one of the very first UFO crash retrievals is because a few years ago, when I was doing a documentary on the Aurora spaceship crash, and we were filming at the Wise County Courthouse, a fellow by the name of Byron Rust and his son came up and said, "Hey, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, you know, we're doing a little documentary about that spaceship crash story over in Aurora." And he said, "Oh, I know all about that. My grandfather was there."
Oh, perfect.
So when I said, "Well, here, sit down, sign this release. I'm going to talk with you." And they got a very good interview with him. But he, for the first time, brought up this fact. He said his grandfather told him that within hours, that representatives of virtually every law enforcement agency in Texas had showed up. And I said, "Well, what did they do?" And he said, "Well, you know, some of them went around and told everybody, 'Okay, it's all over, folks. Go back to your homes. Nothing to see here.'" He said the rest of them were loading up this wreckage in wagons and carting it off. So here's the very real possibility that we had a UFO crash retrieval as early as 1897.
And they took it away.
They took it away.
Oh, my. My, oh, my, oh, my. Hey, Jim, when you're out there in Las Vegas, what's the interest in the UFOs in this entire genre?
Well, George, you know, I think we're seeing a dramatic shift in the public perception. For so many years, of course, we were told by official sources and debunkers that they don't exist. There's nothing there. And most people were willing to go along with that because it kind of hurt their brain to really contemplate that maybe we're being visited by extraterrestrial beings. But you don't hear that anymore because with the advent of the camcorder, there's not a day goes by that somebody's not getting good photographs, tapes of UFOs. So it's obvious that there's something there. So now the fallback position is that, well, it's just misidentified aircraft or secret government test craft. But as I just pointed out, it goes back to 1897. So I think that the general public is becoming more and more aware and more accepting of the idea that this represents something very real.
You know, Jim, I used to believe wholeheartedly that we were talking about extraterrestrials within this universe. I'm now almost beginning to switch, thinking that they're coming from other dimensions or other parallel universes. Have you thought about that at all?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm going to touch on this in my talk tomorrow night at the third annual Crash Retrieval Conference. If you'll think back, George, you know, when we were kids in the 50s and even in the 60s, the burning question was, do they come from Mars or do they come from Venus?
Mm-hmm.
And then by the 70s and the 80s, we've gotten a little bit more sophisticated. The question became, do they come from Zeta Reticula 4 or Alpha Centauri? And today, we're even more sophisticated, and now the question is, do they come from another solar system, a galaxy, or another dimension, or another time? And frankly, if you'll study the material, it seems to be the answer is yes.
It seems to change, as you say, as our technology changes, our views change.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's an interesting concept, too, what they call cultural tracking. Back in the 1890s, when they described these things as silver cigar-shaped, and there were even some people who said that they saw what appeared to be a gondola or fins or propellers. It sounded like a balloon, which was the technology of the period, although there were none flying in the United States at that time. And then, of course, we've got the saucers, and then we've got, today, we've got these triangles, which tends to mimic our delta-winged stealth fighters, stealth bombers. So it's like they're masking themselves to look like something more familiar.
Absolutely. Throw Linda on for just a second, Jim, if we can. Linda, take it away while you're there.
And George?
Kind of explain what's going on out there. Are you like in some huge area?
Hello, George.
Hello.
Yeah.
Linda?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you well.
Okay.
Are you in some huge area? Where are you out there?
Well, we are in the Embassy Suites Hotel and Conference Center, where we're at this third annual conference. And the three of us are sitting at a table. We've been talking about this tonight. And one of the issues that grows out of what Jim was just talking about, if our government did a retrieval in 1897, did another one at least in 1941 from Missouri, it means that there was some team or group in this government that had a long history of at least having knowledge about this. And that leads to the question coming up with Rich Dolan in the next half hour. Why is it that the government of the United States has worked for so long? This would be going back to 1897 up to the current day, keeping all these facts about the interaction of something from someplace else that is defined in their own documents as extraterrestrial biological entities. Why have they worked so hard to keep these facts from the public and the media? And if all of this is true, that there were these earlier crash retrievals, it means that by 1947 in Roswell, they were already prepared. And the fact that that leaked, it was just really an accident because our government was ready to come in there with that balloon explanation and keeping the cover-up going. So in this next half hour with Rich Dolan, I think we'll get into some of the interesting underbelly of why this government worked so hard to keep some of these hard facts secret.
You know, we've been working with some whistleblowers here, Linda, who hopefully very shortly will come forward. They're doing something to protect themselves, and it's going to be a coordinated hit here when this happens between Coast to Coast and another major publication. I cannot reveal who that is yet, but it looks like there could be a handful of some unbelievable government whistleblowers who are going to come forward and tell what they know. And at that point, obviously, we'll bring you in on this, too.
Thank you.
Could be a major, major story.
Yeah, and I'm going to have in my presentation tomorrow a guy from the Air Force who has the most astonishing story about another crash retrieval. And it just shows that underneath so many of these hiding in plain sight areas, the government is very skilled at keeping things hidden. And the only thing that we've got are people willing to come forward and say, you know, the human family deserves the facts.
Absolutely. Earthfiles.com, what's on the website, Linda?
At the top, there are several articles about there were 106 cattle all killed by lightning this week in Australia. Amazing case. It's the most number of animals that I know that's been basically documented with burn marks. A lot of times people wonder if lightning can do that. Well, they did it this week in Australia. I have a fascinating story about the mutilation of sheep just 2 weeks ago in Dartmoor in England, which has probably one of the longest histories of strange animal deaths, strange lights in the sky, strange marks, strange sounds, and it's going on right now as we speak in 2005.
All right, well, stay with us. We'll be right back with Linda Moulton Howe. She's at the third annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. And, of course, her guest coming up with her, Richard Dolan, as we talk about UFOs and the national security state. So don't go away. And Linda Moulton-Howe, of course, is at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference at the Embassy Suites Hotel and Conference Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. She is there now with Richard Dolan. Richard holds an MA in History from the University of Rochester, Bachelor of Arts degree in History from Alfred University, earning a certificate in Political Theory from Oxford University. Now, he has written a series of books. He published a 500-page study of UFOs in the national security state. It was the first volume of a two-part historical narrative of the national security dimensions of the UFO phenomenon from 41 to the present. Now, in 2003, he helped to found the Phenomena, a magazine dedicated to leading-edge issues pertaining to science and society as well. He's there with Linda Moulton-Howe. Take it away, Linda.
Well, thank you, George. And another fact behind this historian's background is he was a finalist for a Rhodes Scholarship. And he comes into this whole strange field, call it the problem of UFOs and trying to figure out what they are, and why the government works so hard to keep the public and the media from knowing what's going on. And he comes at this from the context of somebody very interested in history. And tonight we were talking about how a man who spent and focused so much of his educational life in non-related matters connected to crash retrievals or abductions or any of this, how did he come to be so interested that he did the very, very important reference book, UFOs in the National Security State. And right now I'm going to share with our Coast audience and you, George, Rich Dolan and how he came into this through a very, very important document. Here's Rich.
Great. Hi, Rich.
Hi, George.
How are you?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me on.
Likewise. Just have a conversation with Linda. Sit back, enjoy yourself, and tell us some startling things.
Yeah, you bet. I wanted to finish up on what Linda was introducing, which is simply how I did stumble into this, which was back in 1994, and I was a young, naive grad student at the University of Rochester doing Cold War studies. Really knew nothing about flying saucers or anything of that particular sort, because they don't do that in academia. And I had I don't even know why to this day, but I kind of got interested. I surfed a couple of bulletin board groups on UFOs, and I thought that was interesting. And one day I went into a bookstore and saw a copy of the very excellent book by Timothy Good, Above Top Secret. I'd never seen it before. I'd never heard of it. And it was this great book on a lot of government documentation of UFO phenomena. And I found what is famous among researchers in the field, the so-called Twining Memo, which I had never seen before. And I'm sure, although many listeners are familiar with this, I'll bet there are a lot who are not. The Twining Memo was written by General Nathan Twining, who ran Air Material Command in 1947. Very, very important position. And he's talking about all these flying saucer reports, and he's saying in this classified memo that the phenomenon is something real and not visionary or fictitious. He talks about, it's extremely detailed, the absence of trail, circular or elliptical in shape, flat on bottom and domed on top in 1947? what general? I mean, good grief. Could you imagine if this had been public knowledge at the time? You have a four-star general, a three-star general at the time writing this. So once I kind of got my head wrapped around this reality, I thought there's something very odd. Even if the UFO thing were a big mistake, why is it not in any history book that I ever read, any academic history book? And then that simple question, such a simple, naive little question, kind of sucked me into the field. And here I am now 11 years later.
A giant in the field you are now.
Well, I feel like a kid in the field at times, especially when I deal with so many very, very very experienced people, such as Linda and many others who are at this Crash Retrieval Conference. One thing that I'm very interested in right now as I finish my follow-up book is the whole issue of crash retrievals, because it seems to me that this is a real key to the UFO phenomenon. I mean, this is not a situation simply of lights in the sky and, you know, are there aliens out there and all of that kindergarten-level stuff that you get in the mainstream media even to this day. But rather, as Jim Mars was intimating in his segment as well, this is hardware that's been recovered, and it's been recovered many times. I'm interested in researching a lot of the very reliable firsthand accounts of some very high-level, top-notch people who have had things to say about this. And I'm talking about guys like Senator Barry Goldwater,
sure.
who wrote about this a number of times, statements of the late Ben Rich, who headed Lockheed's division Skunk Works. Ben Rich was a man who was at the top of the top, who had a very strong interest in the UFO phenomenon, and indeed wrote about it and spoke about it publicly toward his later years. Statements by Apollo 14 moonwalking astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell made a number of times discussing independent confirmation from high-level people of deep black programs to study alien
right.
technology and bodies. So,
though he tells us, Richard, and I'm sure he's told you too, he never saw anything personally.
What Mitchell
but he does
has
believe.
Said, though, is that he has what he considers, all right, and this is we have to trust him and his judgment, what he considers to be ultra-reliable individual.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He actually believes
right.
that we've been visited. Yeah, he said that
right.
on this program. And, you know, coming from the mouth of Edgar Mitchell, the
right.
astronaut doctor type, you got to believe him.
And so what the big picture is looking like, George, is simply that this is not just lights in the sky, but there's money involved because this is stuff that's got to be really valuable. And, indeed, you've got the video hounds hanging around at Area 51 and out in Southern California looking at some very exotic aircraft, which is logical, at least is logical to lead one to believe that this is a result of such programs.
You could assume that. I mean, there's no question most of the vehicles that people are seeing around Area 51 are probably made by us. But the big question is where do we get that engineered technology?
That's exactly right. And you know, we're not getting answers from the government, but you've got a lot of people who have been talking about crash retrieval programs. The research of the late Leonard Stringfield. Stringfield was in the Air Force, had a lot of high-level military contacts, over 60, possibly 70 stories that came to him, half of which were direct sources, talking about witnesses of humanoid bodies at Wright Patt Air Force Base, various UFO crashes, a shooting of an alien at Fort Dix, in New Jersey in 1978. This was investigated by many people, and much, much more. And so you can't assume all of these are true, but there were quite a few of these. Stringfield himself wondered, you know, was he being played for disinformation
mm-hmm.
and so on? But his opinion was no. And he, thought about this a lot, and this is what he felt. And I think most of us who looked at this feel the same way.
In modern
Linda has something here she wants to say, too.
Okay, go ahead, Linda.
Well, one of the things that I remember that Ben Rich said was a quote about, we know how to go to the stars, quote unquote, from a man who was working in aerospace technology. Can you flesh that out at all from your research about what Ben Rich might have known firsthand?
Well, yes. Ben Rich made that statement in 1993 at a UCLA School of Engineering alumni get-together. And, in fact, one man attending that was a prominent member of the organization MUFON and was an executive at IBM at the time, was there. I spoke with him directly about it. His name is Jan Harzen. He has no problem with his name being known on this. Ben Rich gave this very kind of standard history of Skunk Works and ended it with the statement, we now have the technology to take E.T. home. And then it was like, good night, everyone. Half the people left because I guess some people have no curiosity about anything, but a few people stayed behind, and Ben Rich chatted with them. They had a lot of questions, and he said, yes, we now know how to travel to the stars, and it won't take us a lifetime to do it. There had been an error in the equation. We've resolved it, and we now know how to travel to the stars. And then he said he offered the opinion that, you know, there are people who would like to keep this all in the black as ultra secret, but that his own belief was that the Cold War was over and, hey, it's time to make this information public. So this is Ben Rich. You know, once again, a very, very big deal that most people are just not aware of statements like this.
And how would you, from the perspective now of 2005, place what Philip J. Corso said in The Day After Roswell about having the assignment to work for the first Army Director of Research and Development in Pentagon, Arthur Trudeau, that Philip Corso's job was to take extraterrestrial technology defined by Trudeau and get it out into corporations to be back-engineered and patented in this country.
Yeah. So it's just a fascinating field in which, you know, the discrepancy between what is officially true in our society, that is what we're supposed to believe, what our mommy and daddy government people tell us to believe, and what is actually true is so vast. George, I honestly did not anticipate it being this massive even.
When you got into it?
No, I really didn't. I mean, I guess I should have, having thought about it. I quickly realized that there was some very, very big stuff going on, a very big cover-up. That's really the right word you can use here.
Sure.
But it goes even farther than I had ever seen.
Might even be bigger than you can imagine.
Yes, indeed. Bigger than one can imagine is exactly right.
How many crashes, Richard, do you think we have possibly had since the end of World War II?
Great question. I've asked myself this. How many? I don't know. I mean, there have been, you can have a conservative estimate of, say, a couple, which is what some ultra-conservative UFO researchers mm-hmm. would argue. On the upper end, you could say more than 50, more than 60.
Oh, my.
I don't know. I mean, there are some where I think the evidence is pretty good. I would say at least a dozen would be safe. I mean, I'm trying to be conservative here.
I tell you, the most perplexing question with that is, if they've got the technology to get here, and I'm beginning, as I was telling Jim Mars a half hour ago, to believe that they're coming through another dimension or another universe. So the conventional thought of they're traveling, you know, trillions of miles to get here probably
right.
doesn't hold water anymore.
Exactly.
But the fact that they would crash
once they
got here. Yeah, that I don't understand.
Well, either maybe we're shooting them down, you got to wonder.
Possibly.
Star Wars, I mean, there's certain.
But you think they'd have shields or something.
One would think so. George, I don't know. I mean, I don't have an exact answer to this either. On the other hand, the good thing for me is I've never felt an obligation to answer every single question in this field. You have to go where the evidence leads you,
yeah.
And this is where it seems to be leading.
And George and Rich, at this point, it's very clear because we've been able in some of the research to find that there were newspaper articles in 1952 talking about how we had artillery that was aimed at, and there was a mission by our government to bring down any and all disks in the sky. Leonard Stringfield said there was a standing order to bring them down. Stanton Friedman knows that we were using experimental microwave to try to bring the disk down. So we were being aggressive. There's also this issue of Trojan horse planting false technology that we would then try to follow up and that would send us down dead ends. But, you know, one of the things here, George, that I hope this audience would appreciate knowing is that Ryan Wood and Bob Wood, who have worked so hard in the Majestic 12 documents, Ryan has put together a book called Magic Eyes Only,
mm-hmm.
working with a lot of us, and it is now a list of about 74 possible crash retrievals, and there's harder evidence in some and less. Tomorrow I'm going to be presenting some interesting data about one that hasn't been presented before. And what is, to me, in amazing in all this is when you report hard facts in one, you get what appears to be frustrated people like the leakers that you were talking about, people who finally come forward, they're frustrated and they say, I have firsthand knowledge about. And right now, one of the values of this radio program, of this conference, of that book, is that there must be a lot of people out there who have some piece of a firsthand knowledge about some of this. And if you do and you're listening, I would greatly appreciate your contacting Earthfiles at earthfiles.com. And I will reach out to these fellow colleagues because this is really, really, if the government won't break open the facts, then it's up to the people who keep pushing for the facts and people who are willing to leak. And that has been propelling, I think, a lot of us in our work and the whole Philip J. Corso discussion about trying to get pieces of extraterrestrial technology into corporations. Maybe, and Rich, this is to you, could Skunk Works probably would have been at the top of the list of the government?
It would have, well, yes, Skunk Works, first of all, gets the most money of any defense contractor in the United States. They are number one. And so it would clearly be logical, looking at all of the different pieces of evidence, you'd have to look at Skunk Works, among other organizations as well.
Well, maybe one day, Richard. I hope in our own lifetime we find out what the heck is going on.
I think we will. Here's why I think so. One thing that I've noticed in my look-see over the last 35 years or so is that there is a relationship. There seems to be some relationship between the release of information on UFOs and political crises in various nations. You think back in American history, we had Watergate in Vietnam, at the end of which a very strengthened Freedom of Information Act. Basically, it was Congress trying to take back power from the executive, which resulted in an enormous cache of thousands of pages of documents. You have in Spain, the death of dictator Francisco Franco released, within a year of his death, hundreds of pages of Spanish military documents on UFOs come out. Same with China after Mao Zedong died in the a year after that. You have the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, early 90s, during which an enormous amount of UFO information was released. Now that, there are lots of political crises where UFO information may not come out, but it can come out in periods of political crisis. And I would argue, or I would suggest, that we here in the United States are approaching a similar kind of crisis. We've got a lot of big things going on here, and the potential is, it seems to me, that a prominent insider, someone who's really who sees the writing on the wall,
and is maybe fed up, Richard. Maybe they're just fed up with the secrecy.
That's right. When all hell breaks loose, a lot of things are possible, and it's my own opinion that we are moving into such an era right now in our own society.
Well, Richard, good luck with you at the conference, and let me wrap things up here with Linda.
Thank you very much, George.
Thank you. Appreciate you being part of the program. That was Richard Dolan. Linda, as we wrap up very quickly, I had an opportunity to have Ed and Chris Sherwood on the program this week, and they believe crop circles come from three distinct possibilities. One, divine, some kind of intervention that way, extraterrestrials, and also people who are committing fraud hoaxes. What do you think?
I think all three of those are highly probable.
Yeah.
And the only one not on that list that I think has been discussed by people I know in the government are literally time travelers. Now, what are time travelers in relationship to those two categories of extraterrestrial
or
divine?
Yeah, that's a good point. Enjoy the conference, and thanks for bringing those two stunning guests along, Linda.
Yes. George, it was a pleasure, and look forward to working with you again, and let me know what happens on that possible development.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The possibility of some really heavy-hitter government whistleblowers who are apparently working on now ways to protect themselves, maybe their identity somewhat, maybe their careers, maybe they just don't want to be hauled off and taken away to the bogey. Who knows?